When I was young, my grandmother told me how to get rid of a wart. Get some spit from your mouth and rub it on. And you've got to do this before breakfast or before you've had anything to drink, because that's when your spit is most toxic. Now, not every so-called medical fact you hear is true. Some widely held beliefs are utter bunkum. And some of the most common are collated in a new book called Don't Swallow Your Gum: Myths, Half-Truths and Outright Lies About Your Body and Health. Dr. Aaron E. Carroll co-authored the book. He's an Associate Professor of Paediatrics and the Director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at the Indiana University School of Medicine. And he joins me now. Welcome to Life Matters, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
I know you're no killjoy, and I'm sure you don't want to ruin people's fun, but you really wanted to, I suppose, look behind the spin with this book, didn't you?
Absolutely, and we hope, actually, that we sometimes allow people to have more fun by actually proving some of these things not to be true.
Who are the worst offenders when it comes to getting these myths out there? Is it magazines, or is it the media, or is it people we know?
I think it's probably your parents. I hate to, you know, blame mom entirely, but, you know, I would have to say most of these things are things we probably hear from our parents. But you're right, a fair number of them come from the media as well, and even some of them do come from doctors.
Can I start with the gum?
Absolutely.
Would it be okay to swallow the gum? Because I did this when I was about 8, and I've been worried about it for quite a long time.
You shouldn't worry at all. It's totally okay. The body is incredibly good at getting things from one end to the other, even things that aren't digestible. In fact, lots of stuff we eat, including many vegetables, really aren't very digestible, and it goes right through. The gum does not stay in your body for 5 years or 7 years or whatever you've heard. It passes right through you.
We'll come back to some of these more fun ones later, but I do want to ask about what seems to me perhaps an important myth, and that is that new drugs on the market are better.
Yeah, this is one that, you know, definitely hits us in the United States, and I expect everywhere else. It's sort of this fascination of believing that every time a new drug comes on the market that somehow it's better and we have to have it, even though it's much more expensive and it's much harder to get. And what we tried to show in that chapter is that a significant number of drugs are barely any different than the drugs that we already have. And it's almost always, with the rare exception, you know, just as good to take the cheap generic drug as it is to take the brand new one at significantly less cost.
I think it is more pronounced in the US than just about anywhere else. But, I mean, I understand in your country that pharmaceutical companies can get away with creating a new drug by doing something which is just removing the mirror image molecule of the old drug.
In fact, yes, it gets complicated in how they do it, but, you know, a lot of drugs that come out there in the last step, they're really a mixture of sort of an active ingredient and an inactive ingredient. And then to make a new drug, all they do is take away the inactive ingredient. You get nothing new. It's the exact same molecule. It's just that they've removed some filler, and they call it a brand new drug. They charge significantly more than the old product, and it's exactly the same molecule. In the most egregious instance that we show in the book, they take a drug and they literally just make it a new color. They make the pill a different color, package it as a new drug, and then sell it for significantly more money. And the FDA in the United States allows this.
Well, that's an example of a myth in which there's an obvious vested interest and a significant effort to propagate the myth.
Absolutely. And you see that in other myths as well. For instance, 8 glasses of water. It sounds, you know, there's a lot of industry these days built up around making you want to drink more water. There's a lot of companies that make a significant amount of money by basically bottling local tap water and then calling it spring water or special water, and then actually pushing the idea that you need to consume an inordinate amount of pure water every day. There is no science behind the idea that you need to drink 8 glasses of water a day. And even the recommendations that recommend that much fluid say that you're very likely to get 8 glasses of fluid through your normal diet, through food, through fruit, through vegetables, through coffee, through tea. No one has ever said you need that much pure water.
Yes, and yet, I mean, almost everybody believes it. And that one is repeated by nutritionists and on websites that are connected to dietitians and people like
and
that.
And even doctors, I think, are guilty of this one. I've been told many times by my doctor to drink 8 glasses of water a day, and to the point where I sort of felt guilty if I wasn't getting enough water, that somehow I was hurting my own health. You shouldn't worry.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Dr. Aaron Carroll. He's at the University of Indiana. He's at the School of Medicine there. And he's co-authored a book called Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths and Outright Lies About Your Body and Health. That's what we're talking about right now. Can we talk about flu shots? Flu's very much on our minds in Australia at this time of year. We've got the swine flu here, and many people, like me, have already had their flu shot for the ordinary seasonal flu. There are people I know who believe that flu shots might give you the flu.
That's a really dangerous myth as well, because as we know, getting a flu shot is often very important. Flu shots cannot cause the flu. They're made of a dead virus. It's something that's dead, that just gets your body to react to it so that later you can fight off the live flu. There is nothing in science which has ever been able to take something that's dead, like a virus, and bring it back to life. And in fact, they've done huge studies where they give people the virus and then follow them, and they have never, ever, ever seen that dead virus come back to life. Of course, when you get the shot, there is a small but real chance you've already been infected with the real flu, or that you might get the flu in the next week or so before the shot has had to take effect. And in that case, you're getting the actual flu. It's not that the shot gave you the flu. You just happen to get sick at the same time. This occurs enough that it sort of causes this myth that people think that has been caused by the shot. But it's simply impossible. The flu shot can only do you good.
One of the problems that our brain seems to have is that we're very good at pattern recognition, and we often find connections when they aren't really there.
Exactly. And we often sometimes believe that things that occur at the same time are somehow caused one by the other. That if something happens near or at the same time, that the first must have caused the second. And that's just not the case in most things. And in fact, that's the cause of a number of the myths that you see in the book, be it reading in the dark might make your eyes hurt, but it's not going to kill your vision. In the same way also that there's a lot of people that believe that shots cause autism, because sometimes the diagnosis of autism comes around the same time as the shot.
Yeah, now that is a controversial one, isn't that? Because
It's very controversial, and people get very upset about it, but the number of enormous studies, I'm talking studies on the hundreds of thousands of people that have been done and been unable to find any link between the diagnosis of autism and the time of a shot, makes it mean that the relationship is either non-existent or so small that we can't detect it on the order of hundreds of thousands of people. And when we see that in science, you have to actually agree that one does not cause the other. That does not minimize the devastation of autism. I have grants actually underway to try to actually look to help to improve the treatment of autism. I think we need to look into the cure. I think we need to look into the diagnosis. But shots are not the answer. And every dollar that we waste trying to keep on proving that that's true is a dollar that could have gone into something to do actual good for autism.
This gets me to, I think, another point that you do address. And that is that you can, and I've had this argument with a woman I know who's a neighbour. You can say all this, and you can say it repeatedly, and you can be having a conversation with an intelligent person, and yet they just refuse to believe. Do you know what I mean?
I totally know what you believe, and that's why, to some extent, we've published two papers previously on this work, and we've just sometimes been blown away by how strongly people believe a lot of these myths and will not let them go, as if sort of they've defined the world by sort of understanding that these simple things are true. And when shown that they're not, and we always show through science, every chapter is very heavily referenced. We're not sort of saying believe us because we say so. We're actually laying out the actual research that has been done on these topics, proving that these things are either untrue or unproven, and yet still people really sometimes fight. As I said, you know, some of them are actually things that people take to heart and they refuse to believe them, and actually will say, well, that may be true for someone else, but for me, for my child, my experience, I know that that's not true. I think it's unfortunately sometimes a misunderstanding about what research means in science, because, you know, sometimes what we do is actually we have to do what we call randomized controlled trials or sophisticated studies where we can actually prove that even if you believe it's true, that if you don't know what we're doing beforehand, that when the study is done, we can prove that these things aren't true. But people, you're right, still often don't want to let them go.
Just one or two to finish up, Aaron. And these are about hair, which I know people will be interested in. Grey hair. If you pluck one out, you get two in its place.
No, it's totally untrue. This is another one where, because it happens at the same time, people believe it to be true. When you pluck out a hair, it can actually take, you know, a month for it to actually grow back to where you might actually see it again in a full head of hair. And in that time, other hairs are very likely to go gray. And so if you pull one out, it may be that it, by the time that gray hair grows back, another hair has turned gray. And therefore people think, oh my gosh, plucking it is what made the other hair turn gray. It's not true.
Yeah, well, you get onto another thing there, which was that if you cut or shave hair, it grows back more thickly. I've known several women who really believe that about their legs, for example.
Yep, and I had to convince my wife that this one was not true as well. And it's just not. It's an illusion. When you cut hair, when it grows back, it's darker at first when it comes through the skin because it hasn't had time yet to be bleached by the sun or other light. It can feel a little bit coarse or sharp because it's coming through blunt, and it hasn't yet had time to be softened by rubbing up against clothes or other material. So it might look darker, thicker, coarser originally, but by the time it grows back in, it's exactly the same as it was. And again, don't take my word for it. They've done studies where they would shave one leg and not the other, let the hair grow back in, and then try to get people to guess which hair, which leg had been shaved. Of course, they can't because the studies show the hair grows back in just exactly as it did before and you're unable to tell the difference.
As a man who doesn't have the hair on his head that he used to have, I wish it were otherwise. Otherwise, I'd just shave my head and everything would be fine.
Exactly, and there's so many of these, if you just think about it in sort of a different way like that, it's like, of course, if it was true, we would tell all men who were balding to just start shaving their heads. It would grow back darker, thicker, coarser, and we would have, again, have a cure for baldness. It's simply not the case. And if it's not the case for balding men, it's not the case for all hair.
All right, Aaron, that is where we'll leave it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Anytime. Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Aaron Carroll. He's Associate Professor of Pediatrics and the Director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at the Indiana University School of Medicine. And the book which he's co-author of is Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths and Outright Lies About Your Body and Health. It's published by Penguin Books. I would not be at all surprised if you want to get in touch after hearing some of those things. The way to do it is the website abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters. You can send us an email from there or jump on the guest book. And the other thing you can do is give us a ring, 02-833-1430. This is Life Matters, and you're with Richard Adie on ABC Radio National.